I guess it was coincidental that we scheduled this at the same day the president's in Cuba. Maybe he can go a little farther to the east and get over to Puerto Rico and pay some attention to what we think is a fairly important place. And we're just delighted to have you here today. I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO of the American Security Project. I think most of you are familiar with us. 501c3 founded 2005 by some guys named Carey and Hagel, Hart and Rudman, and we've continued ever since. It's a modest operation, but our primary focus is the intersection between foreign policy and national security. And we've built the organization that way. Have a number of flag officers, 3- and 4-star, one of them sitting right here, Admiral Gunn, our former president, on our board, and a number of businessmen, another one, Alejandro Brito, is on our board as well, and another one, Dante Disparti, who runs our business council. This year, our focus is going to change a little bit, and we're going to shift somewhat to Latin America and South America, and we're just delighted to talk about Puerto Rico today. This is all going to be on the record. We are taping it. We'll have it up on our website tomorrow, so you know, don't take too many notes. Dante will be the moderator. Each participant will talk maybe 5 to 7 minutes. Then we'll do a Q&A among the four of you, and then we'll open up to questions in the audience. Same rules will apply. We'll have a roving microphone. Dante will pick who the questioner is. If you've got a question, please keep it short and make it a question, and please let us know who you are because it'll all be on the record as well. You know, it's interesting when you talk Puerto Rico, especially today when the president's out over on Cuba, you kind of go, Puerto Rico, oh, geez, there's a bit of a crisis in Puerto Rico, and Governor, I'm so pleased you're here, and Representative you as well, who can probably address this in far more eloquent terms than I can. But it's something that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed right now. And I think the Americans' attentions are obviously focused on a presidential campaign and other items, and sometimes we lose sight of things that are really close to our shore, Puerto Rico being one of them. So we're going to open up our year with this program, and then we're going to shift over to Cuba here later in the summer and the fall and do a Cuba program as well. But again, I'm delighted that you're here. I think it's a great time for us to be talking about this subject, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dante.
Great. Thank you, General Cheney, and welcome everyone to this afternoon's discussion on Puerto Rico, and especially want to extend a warm welcome to our guests this afternoon, including Alejandro Brito to my right. He's a business person from Puerto Rico and a leading property developer in the Caribbean, among many other activities. We have a representative, Mr. Hernandez Montañez, who is the chairperson of the House Treasury Committee representing the island, and I think brings a very unique perspective to this conversation of how things are developing in Puerto Rico, what types of legislative moves have been made. And then rounding off our discussion this afternoon, we have the Honorable Luis Fortuño, the former governor of Puerto Rico, served from 2009 to 2013. And obviously each of us maintains a very clear interest in the island. Myself, I was born there. Born and raised in Puerto Rico, have family and, of course, business interests in Puerto Rico. So I think, you know, just to open up the panel discussion and turn to each of our speakers for their opening remarks, I want to set the stage. The island of Puerto Rico, currently home to 3 and some change million American citizens, ground zero for the municipal debt crisis that has affected many parts of the United States and iconic cities like Detroit and other areas. In Puerto Rico's case, we're talking a very large number, $72 billion in public debt, crippling. And when you have citizenship and a population with a U.S. passport, the vicious cycle that this public debt is creating is that it is in effect shrinking the tax base of the island, because those that can pack up, leave, get on the next JetBlue flight, land somewhere else. And so there's a lot of knock-on consequences of those choices. The other aspect to set the stage is energy and energy security. So at the centerpiece of the debt crisis, you have the public utility, PREPA, the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority. And with an energy bill 3 to 4 times higher than the U.S. mainland, you can imagine that this starves out purchasing power for Puerto Rican households and businesses. And so on many fronts, what happens in Puerto Rico, I think it has a broad public interest in the United States. We're in fact speaking of the southernmost U.S. territory. We mentioned Puerto Rico. Historically and even today has always been an important outpost for the American military and for broader interests in commerce. Once we had one of the largest bases of pharmaceutical manufacturing on the planet and a very diversified economy. So I think that Puerto Rico in many regards is ground zero for the municipal debt crisis affecting the U.S. As goes our debt, so goes America's creditworthiness and the good faith and credit of this government. So we're very much looking forward to a spirited discussion. Once each of our panelists has given some opening remarks, we'll turn to the audience for some Q&A, and I'll try and steer the conversation as much as I can. So with that, we will start with our good friend, the representative.
Thank you, Dante. It's an honor. Thank you for everything, everybody over here. Thank you, Governor. It's a pleasure to be with you and a friend of mine, Brito. Thank you for inviting me to share with you my view as the fiscal and financial crisis in Puerto Rico. As a chairman of the Financial Committee of the House of Representatives, we are responsible for the drafting legislation that address key financial issues and provide solutions to many fiscal problems we have been facing in the last three years. In the view of Puerto Rico issue, I view Puerto Rico issue in a holistic manner, a triangle with three main challenges: certainty in the revenues collected by Treasury Department, expenses control, and debt service. As a certainty in the revenue collected by the Treasury, we have just been informed by the Secretary that revenue recorded by the general funds in February 2016 in the consumption tax increased significantly compared to the same months years before, and we are higher than the revised estimates. The main reason for this excellent news is the increase in collections of the sales and use tax. This is a result of legislation approved in the past 3 years. In 2015, the increase on consumption tax, I like it to call consumption tax because we amend the used to be a sales tax, and we make some changes in the way that it really is a consumption tax, more than just a simple sales tax. We call it IBU, from 6% to 10.5%, and a new 4% in B2B taxes on professional services. In 2014, the transition in the structure of the sales tax and use tax, IBU, to the value-added tax in the tangible goods, or the goods that you resell. In 2013, the change of the use tax for importation of goods, not for resales, in the peers. And also, it's very important for the first time in many years, the Treasury Department is diligently enforcing our tax laws and filing criminal charges against violators. All Puerto Ricans are totally fully aware that tax laws are enacted by the legislature, enforced by the executive, and must be complied by the taxpayers. But let me make one last statement about our tax system. It has to be a balanced system. Everybody must pay its fair share of the tax burden. It has to be a system that generates the revenues that are required by the government to provide essential services to the citizens. We are moving toward taxing consumption, providing relief or regressivity where it needs, and easing the burden on productions and low-income individuals. But also we need a tax system that stimulates the economy. Economic growth is the primary objective of all our legislation. The second challenge, expenses control, has been a priority of my committee. In fiscal year 2012, the last year of the previous administration, expenses in the general funds was 11.9 billion. In fiscal year 2013 to 2014, the first year of these administrations, expenses went down to 9.9 billion. In 2014 to 2015, 9.6 billion, and in 2015 to 2016, the current budget is 9.8 billion with a reserve of 500 million reserve established by the legislature, and this was achieved without foreign government employees. The ongoing budget for fiscal year 2015-2016 has been adjusted to 9.3 billion, and the Financial Committee of the House will recommend a budget for fiscal year 2016-17 that will be the $500 million less without reserve than the general budget of 2015-16 expenses. This control in expenses is a direct result of the Act 66 approved by the legislature of 2014, which pursued fiscal and operational stability in all government agencies and the central government. I provide a legal framework and mandate specific reduction in expenses, such as consultants, payroll, frozen benefits, in expenses in expenditures in labor contracts, among others. Expenses control is a priority of the committee I chair. The third and last challenge that Puerto Rico faces, I want to talk about, is the servicing our debt. Everybody in there is agree that the government cannot serve this $70 billion debt in contract. So we must restructure. The issue then is what we have to do, but rather how we do it. Just to remind you, Puerto Rico first bond offering was in 1945 when the government decides to purchase the electricity company for private owners and create the first public corporation in the island. These were the years of the New Deal in the United States with the President Roosevelt advocating for government control of public service. We create a series of public corporations to assist in the economic development on the island, and they flourish. We borrow. Puerto Rico had accessed the U.S. municipal bonds market since the beginning. As you all know, this is the most attractive source of capital for any public jurisdiction in the United States, as the federal government exempt for taxes all interest earned on bonds issued by municipalities as public entities. In recent years, a significant amount of capital flow to the municipal bond market and investors looking for higher yield were attracted to Puerto Rico bonds, since they provide triple tax exemptions. Puerto Rico took advantage of this and borrowed to invest in infrastructure and cover budget deficits due to the prolonged economic recession that some call now a depression. So here we are today with a huge amount of debt, dwelling revenues, and maturity that we cannot pay as contracted. We have to sit down with creditors and find solutions to this challenge. This is a willingness. There is a willingness to pay, but not under the terms and conditions that the debt was negotiated. Not because we don't want to, but because we don't have the cash flow to pay. In my opinion, the economic team of my government was too optimistic in the believing that they were going to be able to save the credit of Puerto Rico where they took over the government. Instead, we must sit down with creditors in those agencies that we are certain need to be restructuring. The best example is PREPA, a concentrated joint effort by the authorities management, the GDB, the legislatures, both House and Senate, and the different creditors reached an agreement to restructure the authority debt. My committee just recommended at the House approved by bipartisan votes 35 and 10 legislation to provide the legal framework to the PRASA, that is a Puerto Rico Water and Sewer Authority, to securitize its debt proactively without the need of restructuring. This will provide access to both markets once again, and I propose that we do the same with COFINA bondholders, GEO's bondholders, and all the creditors in Puerto Rico. Who can believe that Puerto Rico, or for that matter, any political jurisdiction, can survive without access to the capital markets? Granted that we overexpend ourselves, and we should have been more prudent, and we borrow mainly to invest in infrastructure, but whatever we do, we must regain the confidence of the market so that we can continue to attract capital to Puerto Rico. This is our responsibility. I am confident that we will achieve it Puerto Rico will restructure his obligations one by one, avoiding a default at all costs, and we will regain access to the capital market. I have shared with you what I consider to be the three most important challenges that Puerto Rico faces today. I thank you for the for your patience. I am looking forward to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hernandez, for your opening remarks. Indeed, I think of most financial crises, how we got here matters less than what we do now. And I think the representative's comments underscore how many choices and how many actions have been taken locally on the island. I think few options and few of the arrows that are in the policy quiver have been left. And so with that, we turn to the perspective of a business person. So you're on the receiving end of some of these changes. What's it like being Alejandro Brito right now and leading a development company?
Well, doing business in Puerto Rico. First of all, good afternoon to everybody, members of the board and guests and press and my friends here to the right. As a businessman, it's a tough time doing business in Puerto Rico because the enemy of investment and of businesses right now, it's uncertainty. And what you have in Puerto Rico is that every day you have some improvisation or you have a new tax or taking away a new tax or new impositions. I mean, it is really, really complicated. It's a little bit like Greece at the beginning of last year, whether it was going to default or not or be part of the European Union. I mean, it is very complicated. I'm going to give you my perspective, not only as a businessman, but also as a citizen of Puerto Rico. I live full time in Puerto Rico. I travel every week to New York for work. So I see more or less both sides of the coin. So I'm going to read a little statement because I knew that my fellow panelists were going to be super prepared. So I didn't come with bullet points. I actually read it. I wrote it yesterday. So after seeing what has developed in the island in the last 10 years of recession or depression and the bleak prospects ahead of us, I have come to the conclusion that the island needs a federal emphasis on federal fiscal control board with as absolute and far-ranging powers as possible. By far-reaching, I mean that it not only controls the finances of the core government, but also of the troubled public corporations, in particular PREPA, which is the electric utility, the waterworks, PRASA, and the highway authority. My position is contrary to that taken by all political parties in Puerto Rico that argue that a federal fiscal control board with wide-ranging powers is a violation of the sovereignty of the island. Furthermore, I have been reading from local economists and think tanks that Puerto Rico has the wherewithal, tools, and will to get it right this time. Basically, my presentation is based on countering these arguments. My position, again, when Detroit and DC were imposed a fiscal control board, they were certainly not happy, especially considering the sensitive issue of race, primarily African-American populations in both major cities. Years later, it proved to be the right decision, with the CFO of the board of Washington, D.C., eventually becoming the mayor for two terms, Anthony Williams. When Wall Street and the financial institutions were basically assigned the fiscal control board in 2008, even worse, intervened by the federal government, every banker and CEO complained about government intervention. TARP, control of compensation, decision-making, mergers determined by the Fed. One day it was Hank Paulson of Bank of America, you're going to buy Merrill Lynch, and so on. Capital ratios. To this day, Goldman Sachs is still upset that he had to become a chartered commercial bank. And Jamie Dimon, Obama's banker, complains incessantly of government meddling. But at the end of the day, it saved our financial system. And third, I have an example that it doesn't apply to the United States, but in Italy, a technocrat government led by prestigious European Central Bank President Mario Monti, an ex-Goldman Sachs banker, tried to implement reforms to save the Italian economy when it was headed. But right when it was heading in the right direction, he was toppled by a populist movement led by a comedian, Beppe Grillo. The same thing happened in Greece. That gave the right to Syriza, and now it's happening in Spain with Podemos. In summary, nobody likes to have their powers or decision-making curtailed, not only in politics, but it's human nature. The argument of political parties in certain sectors in Puerto Rico regarding the Federal Fiscal Control Board is that we don't need it nor want it, and that we are more than capable of dealing with the problem. Their arguments are two. This time, we'll get it right. We just need Chapter 9. And the other argument, we just need to solve the status and all of our problems will be solved. Counter argument number one, Puerto Rico is like that person that has trouble with obesity, gambling, or alcohol, and is permanently trying to quit but can't. Repeats, this time I promise I will tackle the problem. Believe me, I will. When it finally fails and there's only abyss ahead, an intervention takes place and the person is provided assistance, but not under the previous failed self-help, Anthony Robbins treatments. Yes, I have it under control. No, this time it's going to be like boot camp, where tough love, personal trainer, just like the Biggest Loser TV show, controls your diet, exercise routine, calorie intake, and makes decisions that upsets the patient in the short run. If all goes well, the patient is healed or saved and has a new lease on life. I mentioned three malaise above, you know, obesity, gambling, and alcohol. The malaise affecting Puerto Rico is populism. In my personal opinion, the Federal Fiscal Control Board is that boot camp trainer helping the island rid itself of 60 years of populist economic policies that have enveloped the bone marrow of the island's economy. In order to understand the depth of populism in the economy of the island and the grip it has on the ability of any government, of any regardless of the political party in power, let's do a really quick review. 1952, the Commonwealth is founded by Luis Muñoz Marín and the Popular Democratic Party, Popular Party based on social justice. In 1969, a Republican New Progressive Party leader, MIT grad, Republican, institutes the Christmas bonus for salary justice. Again, populism is not exclusive to any particular party. 1977, the nationalization of the shipping and phone companies in Puerto Rico, similar to what happened in Venezuela and Argentina. 1980, the right to vote is given to felons. They actually vote ahead of us and first than the regular population. 1999, the right to unionize government employees, universal health care, that was done under a pro-statehood governor. 2001, law of special communities, and a $1 billion perpetual trust. That is like, I mean, you don't get more populist than that. It's a failed program in Puerto Rico, designing, you know, stigmatizing certain communities that you're poor, we're gonna help you, we're gonna build a little court and give you a self-help guide. It failed miserably. 2006, the increase from $200 to $600 on the Christmas bonus. This passed unanimously in the legislature, both House, Senate, and governor. Not one vote against. This is for people who work more than 700 hours a year, and you don't get a single hour of work. You don't get a single pill manufactured. You don't get anything. I mean, it just discourages work. The same thing you can say with PREPA, waterworks, the CRIM, property taxes. Any house basically in Puerto Rico under $150,000 is exempt. So that means that more than 75% of the universe of housing in Puerto Rico is exempt from paying property taxes. So just a few of us actually carry the load for services. Again, populism has no political party. It's embedded in our political DNA. The party in the opposition turns more populist than ever, and vice versa when there's a change of power. So sometimes you see that the party that was in power tried to move through this legislation, and when they lose, they actually are against their own legislation that they wrote in the first place. Right now, we have some major double talk and political discourse going to that this time we can do it. For example, the Kruger Report says that we should abolish the minimum wage, but right now we have projects in the legislature seeking to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. They're alive, these projects, in the Senate. Kruger Report, we should increase productivity, projects to shorten the work week to 32 hours while maintaining the same amount of salary. Attract foreign investment, projects in the legislature to increase taxes on foreign corporations. Enhance domestic investment. There's a project to increase capital gains to 30% to local investors like myself, while foreign investors on Law 20 and 22 are exempt or they pay a maximum of 4%. other situations, the co-ops in Puerto Rico, they're like little credit unions that we have in Puerto Rico. They're broke because they invested in government bonds. Legislature solved that problem. Let's amend the Financial Accounting State Standards Board that says that you don't have to realize your losses. You can do it over a long period of time. Problem solved. We have a chief technology officer in Puerto Rico at cabinet, that was a new position named at cabinet level, and the Department of Economic Affairs invests millions in startups and hackathons in Puerto Rico. We don't have Uber in Puerto Rico. They have it in the Dominican Republic, but we don't have it in Puerto Rico. But we try to portray ourselves as a Caribbean Palo Alto. There's no money for highways, but we insist on being the only dependency of the United States, or the only state with an 18-year-old drinking age, which costs us tens of millions of dollars a year. Casinos are all closing. We don't amend the gaming laws, in which the government takes a 52% take of all games. And we don't modify our gaming laws so we can bring a sports book so it makes Puerto Rican casinos more competitive against our competitors in the Caribbean. Retail dying, loss of jobs, no sales tax collections. Let's pass an anti-big box and anti-Walgreens law that anything over 15,000 square feet has to go through a process that is so encumbersome that nobody's going to open another big box. It can be IKEA, it can be H&M, things that we need in Puerto Rico. It can be an Apple store. But let's just throw that wrench on the wheel. Only with a federal fiscal control board can we navigate the dangers of extreme populism and execute the reforms that need to be taken in order to get the housing order. The reason that I brought the technocrat government in Italy is that it didn't have the power, and in some cases the will, to see the necessary and always unpopular measures through. Unlike what happened in Italy, that they got voted out after 18 months, the federal fiscal control board in D.C. couldn't be kicked out. The same thing in Detroit. Actually, in D.C., it ended 4 years earlier than they were supposed, 1999 to 2009. It was named for 10 years because they got 4 years in a row of balanced budgets. The political cost is too much. And I don't blame the politicians. I blame the system. We're seeing the rise all over the world of populism. And it's not only in Venezuela, Puerto Rico, or Brazil, but also in Spain, like I said before, in Podemos, in Italy, Five Stars, and now in the USA, Trump and Sanders. I was reading the New York Times yesterday, and in its cover was the new word, Trumpismo, which is like Trump and Chavismo, or Trump and Populismo. And Latin American nations are afraid of this. Or the Bernie, with a burn, you know. Smart politicians, and Puerto Rican politicians are very smart, know how to tap the anger and pain of a 10-year recession. Currently, the politicians with the highest approval ratings in Puerto Rico are its most populist, anti-government, and in some cases of the same party in power, held by a populist press, in which for many years the most famous reporter in Puerto Rico was a doll, La Comay. And where every day radio opens with the scandal of the day, el escándalo del día. Again, I go back now to we only need chapter 9. I believe that the debt is unpayable, just like the representative said. Simple math, $73 billion debt on an island with a budget of $9 billion is more than 7 years without spending a cent and not paying interest. We need an organized restructure of the debt, but we also and foremost need to tackle our structural problems. Because even with 100% debt relief, imaginary, we would be back in the same position down the line. On the other hand, I believe a strong federal fiscal control board is a much better and tougher negotiator for any debt relief than any restructuring firm or advisor that the island currently has. Negotiating against the federal government is not a pleasant experience. Ask the bankers from TARP 2008 or the auto bailout executives when they were in front of Congress, when they came in their private planes. The island hasn't been able to submit audited financial statements for 2014, and the last 10 years of government tax revenue has always been overstated by both political parties. Fool me once, shame on me, so on. For investors and the citizenship in general, just the fact that we will have certainty with a fiscal control board, good or bad, opens the door to investment in the short, medium, and long-term planning. Again, regardless if it's good or bad. There are funds that are just invested in countries where there's massive turmoil or debt, like Argentina before last year or Brazil. And last, the argument, once the status is resolved, all will be fine. I take exception that all political parties are saying the same discourse. Default and solution is the status. My response is that mismanagement is mismanagement under statehood and hence Commonwealth and independence. Illinois has massive problems where a center-left mayor is attacked by the unions. As Brazil and Venezuela are in chaos after years of populist spending and mismanagement. Let's get the housing order and then address the status. It's like a patient with a gunshot wound worried about long-term diabetes. You got to get your priorities straight. Again, more Medicaid and more food stamps don't motivate people to work or study. Also, deals with China. You know, a lot of people claim that we can cut deals with China and other countries are not the panacea that they seem. Just ask Venezuela, that owes China $46 billion, or the Bahamas. China basically has a grip on them because of Bahamar and the new airport that they gifted them. In closing, I believe in the capacity, the will, and in the work ethic of the good people of the island of Puerto Rico. Unfortunately, the system is broken and doesn't work anymore. I also believe in the goodwill of the politicians that we have and had, and the solutions that over the last few decades they have tried to implement. Some systems simply don't work. Much more developed countries like France, the creator of the 34-hour work week, and the tax on the great fortune, 3% of all of your assets, and 90% tax on overtime. Italy, you know, lifetime employment, jobs passed from father to son. It's incredible that they cannot pick the garbage in Naples and Rome. Are also wrestling with the same demons. Spain is ungovernable right now because of the rise of Podemos. That is why the Federal Fiscal Control Board with plenary powers is not a curse. It's an opportunity to fix a broken system where others don't have that tool. Populist revolts always stop them. It has worked before in DC. Let's not be afraid of the opportunity. In reality, nothing can be worse than what we currently have or have endured for the last 10 years. I'm going to throw out quickly just a couple of examples in which a federal fiscal control board can help Puerto Rico with no federal funds. The workman's compensation. In Puerto Rico, workman's compensation is a state-held monopoly, fully unionized, both rank and file and management, and it's a political appointment. Ultra-high premiums. They're abusively high, the premiums. Absolutely bad patient services for injured workers. There's no appeal board and no fraud investigations. The mayor of a major city in Puerto Rico that was diagnosed with schizophrenia was collecting benefits at the same time that he was a mayor. I mean, and nothing happened to him. It's also the piggy bank of the government because the wages, the premiums are so high and the services are so bad that there's always a gigantic buffer. And what the government does is that every time they need $100 million or $200 million to square the, you know, to balance the budget, they go over there and they just raid it. I think that it should be done like in other states that sometimes you have a hybrid or you have private. If it's going to move the government to being more efficient, investigating fraud. And also, at the end of the day, it's about workmen's safety. So if I had blanket immunity, how worried am I or how motivated am I to provide the most, you know, safe work environment other than OSHA? There always has to be an economic factor in it. Another one, Channel 6, WIPR. Does a bankrupt government need a TV channel on radio stations? Total political thing. The president of the corporation is the wife of the campaign manager of the sitting governor. Right now, the FCC is making an offer for $400 million and change for the licenses. The University of Puerto Rico, again, it's fully political. It's a merry-go-round every 4 years. Lower amount of students, same amount of campuses. Let's close a few of them. Build dorms instead. It's cheaper. This formula that they automatically get 9.6% of the board of the budget, regardless, has to change. And there has to be metrics. Has to be result-driven. You know, the quality of the students, how they rank the university in the world, the amount of patents that they get, the amount of awards. And finally, the tourism company, the election bounty. The ad agency that supports the governor's race, and the governor and gets the account. The governor went, gets the election bounty, which is the account of tourism company. It's close to $100 million a year. No consistent message from the destination. Every 4 years, it changes the focus depending on the political party. The funny thing is that both parties oppose a destination management organization to handle the campaign. This is only a snippet of possible areas in which a federal fiscal control board can start working, again, with no federal funds involved, just maximizing the resources at hand and cutting waste and fraud. Therefore, I ask Congress and the administration to please legislate a federal fiscal control board with as far-ranging powers as possible, as soon as possible. In short term, it can be accompanied by measures that have no fiscal impact on the federal budget, such as eliminating the Jones Act, allowing sports books in Puerto Rico, eliminating FHA impositions in housing, increasing FHA to 225%, like Bush did, allow an international transit lounge at the airport so we can get more connecting flights. Right now, you need a full-fledged federal U.S. visa. Allow pharmaceutical companies to expand operations in Puerto Rico with money held abroad. Invest more in Puerto Rican infrastructure. Invest more in the military projects. The security of Puerto Rico is the security of the United States. And relax some EPA restrictions. Thank you very much for your attention.
So I think we found a chair for the Fiscal Control Board.
Yeah.
Alex, thank you. We promised candor and brutal honesty, and I think we got a good glimpse of that right now. So thank you for your remarks, Alex. And I think it's fitting to give the last word and opening remarks to Governor Fortuño.
Sure. Thank you. And I thank the American Security Project, and certainly it's a pleasure to be here with you. Perhaps I should give you a brief background. I worked in the private sector all my life. I was disgusted. As disgusted as Alejandro with government, went into government and tried my best, and I was booted out. Of course, as a result of that, of slashing expenses by $2 billion and laying off thousands of government employees, among many other things, and trying to work with the devils in the system. So to a great degree, I echo many of the frustrations that the private sector has to endure every day just to get by and get things moving. The present situation presents what I consider a daunting challenge and a unique opportunity at the same time. The challenge is that decreasing population has actually accelerated dramatically, especially in the last couple of years. That is eroding the tax base and trying to tax your way out of a crisis like this one gets you nowhere. An underperforming economy that if you go back, I don't know if that's me or... okay, an underperforming economy that if you go back to the last 10 years, with the exception of a slightly positive territory for a year and a half between 2011 and 2012, really it has been in a constant recession since then. No market access at this moment, and the most troubling challenge is a shattered credibility. And it's not just credibility in the municipal market. It's credibility across the board for the local investors and investors from outside the island. If you were to bring an expansion, for example, in the manufacturing operation in Puerto Rico at this moment, bring it to a board of directors meeting, that has nothing to do with the municipal market, but I guarantee you there'll be qualms, serious qualms, amongst the members of the board to go forward with any type of investment in Puerto Rico. So under those circumstances, what's needed, I would say, number one, is to restore the rule of law. And the rule of law, actually, one way of restoring it is through a federal fiscal control board. And I have been in favor of that as part of a larger package. It cannot be just... that, nothing else. And it's part of what the congressional actions that perhaps Congress is considering at this moment. Expenses have to be controlled significantly. And, of course, you have to improve collection. Not raise taxes, but improve collections in the process. Secondly, you need full transparency. There's really no excuse for not providing that full transparency. That requires adequate institutional controls and trustworthy data. and that is a problem at this moment that has been mentioned before. Thirdly, you need sustained economic growth. That's the underlying problem here. If the economy doesn't grow, you can do all the rest, and you will not be able to get out of this one. In order to grow the economy, it's not spending more on government. I remember every year I would introduce a budget, and the budget will be lower than the previous year. And the question that I was getting from members of the press and others was, so what's wrong? How come you're not increasing expenses? I said, that's exactly the opposite of what we need to do. We need to control expenses. But we need to go further than that. And as the population shrinks, so does should everything else. I'll give you one example. In the last 3 years, the public education system has 45,000 less students, yet it has 5,200 more teachers. Just makes no sense. I would love to have one teacher per student. We can afford it. No one can afford it. Actually, the ratio in the mainland is 16 to 1. The ratio at this moment is 11 to 1. That cannot actually be persistent. Regulatory reform. Getting any type of permits in Puerto Rico is just close to impossible. And we were discussing it earlier before coming here. That has to be, and I would say that if there is federal intervention, it should include regulatory reform as well. Public-private partnerships. I remember the airport deal in Puerto Rico. The Port Authority, when I came into office, was of the five top public corporations, the one that was in the worst financial shape. Today, no one is talking about the Port Authority. But on top of that, the airport needed significant investments. As a result of the public-private partnership agreement, significant investments have been occurring, and the Port Authority's a significant portion of the Port Authority's debt has been paid out. That could be a model, again, could be used in many other areas as well. We need to lower the cost of energy. And there's really, at this moment, we're sitting pretty because the cost of oil is at an all-time low, but that will not last. Actually, we saw last week, as oil starts coming up, we need to lower the cost of energy with alternative sources of energy, mostly natural gas, but certainly renewable and others. And I believe that at this moment, about 32% of the power generation is in private hands. It should be 100% in private hands. Puerto Rico has been moving in that direction. It has to continue moving in that direction. Another important item is that in the process, regardless of any type of restructuring negotiations, a clear priority of credits must be respected. There are 18 different entities that have issued bonds with different legal frameworks, and they have to be respected in the process. So and each of them have a distinct liquidity situation. It will be a mistake to equate one with the other. Just to give you an example, and actually the representative has been mentioning this lately in the press. If Puerto Rico defaults on its constitutional debt, for example, that's coming up in July, it will be by choice. Regardless of what happens or doesn't here in D.C., Puerto Rico, apparently based on the public statements that the representative has made, Puerto Rico does have options in terms of negotiating with those creditors. It should explore those options aggressively and try to avoid a default. A default will be a scar that will actually haunt future generations for many, many years to come. So that's extremely important. Puerto Rico has to somehow be able to regain access to the markets again and be able to improve services in the process. So that's just one example. Same thing could be said, I'm sure, about PREPA and the consensual agreement that they reach, and the legislature recently approved some legislation along those lines. But defaults have to be avoided at all costs, and apparently there is a willingness on the part of some creditor groups to actually engage in those negotiations. The process must pave a return. This process must pave a return to the financial markets, not shut that access for years to come. It should be the opposite. And as I mentioned earlier, avoiding default is key here. Finally, execution and political will. Public policies that have provided results must be continued, and those that are not must be eliminated. And in that sense, outside entities could be very helpful in trying to measure what produces results and what doesn't. And based on that, strictly on that, not it's what's politically expedient, make decisions as we move forward. In closing, I would like to say, because a lot has been said, the bottom line here is that Puerto Rico, out of this process, must restore its credibility. And I'll actually try to actually draw a parallel with another part of the Americas, Argentina. Argentina was shut out of the markets for over 10 years. The Argentinian situation actually was, even though it may seem impossible to believe, much worse than Puerto Rico's in terms of the inflation rate, in terms of what was going on, with what at one point was a powerhouse, globally speaking. Argentina, in the first 100 days of President Macri, has been able to turn that around 180 degrees, and it's moving in the right direction at this moment. Public policies and public discourse matters and affects how people actually execute their businesses, how people think about a place, and Argentina could be a model. And that's why I'm saying this presents an opportunity. If Puerto Rico does this correctly, it could be another Argentina at a different level, size, of course, size-wise, but certainly a different level. And that's what I'm hoping that will happen. All of my family live in Puerto Rico, and I certainly want my kids to have a future in Puerto Rico. The only way to do it is implementing the right public policies. Recently, through a foundation in a private university in Puerto Rico, we have been promoting economic freedom. And economic freedom is allowing people like Alejandro to be able to invest with full certainty of what will happen, full certainty as to how quickly will he get his permits, full certainty as to what his tax brackets will look like so that he can plan ahead. If Alejandro cannot do that, it will be impossible to ask Alejandro and others in Puerto Rico and people from outside Puerto Rico to believe that they can make a future in the island. Thank you again.
Thank you, Governor Fortuño. It's just to kind of open up for a more interactive discussion, then shortly we'll turn to the audience. Taking the devil's advocate view, there's an expression that if you owe the bank $10,000, the bank owns you. And that if, by contrast, you owe the bank $100 million, you own the bank. And so some folks are doubling down on Puerto Rico, and they're making comparisons not to Argentina but to Singapore. And investors like John Paulson have put in, you know, $1.5 billion of his own capital in investing in the island. There's all these acts, 20 and 22, that are supposedly drawing in investors to Puerto Rico. And so, you know, how, and I guess this would be an open question, but perhaps we could start with Governor Fortuño. How do you see that argument that is being made and this wave of investors that are coming into the island? Also claiming, as they are, that, you know, here you have the future Singapore of the Caribbean.
If there are investors that are purchasing at undervalued property, that's one story, but that is no foundation for an economy. So if you're paying 20 cents on the dollar for a property, well, that's great. If you just look at actually what is that property is producing, if it's income-producing property, like commercial property and so on. But that is no way to actually build an economy. And the proof is in what's going on at this moment in terms of not just the massive exodus that's occurring, but the fact that all major economic indicators are down, significantly down, with the exception of tourism. And the reason for that is that over 90% of the tourism depends on the eastern corridor up here. The economy here is getting better, so people are going down. But that is really the only reason for it. Actually, even in the portion that deals with internal tourism, that number is down as well. So again, all major economic indicators, you go through car sales, home sales, retail sales, power consumption, you go down the list, and they're all down. So I don't think that's the way to look at this. All you have is a lot of people And I don't blame anyone being able to take advantage of undervalued properties and properties that eventually should come back. And but if you just measure, I was talking to someone the other day that actually is investing in small shopping centers in Puerto Rico. If you just look at the income flow that is produced from that property and what that person paid for a couple of those shopping centers, it makes a lot of sense for that person, but not for the business owners that are there, not for the consumers that are there, and not for the employees that live down there.
That's fantastic. In crisis, there are great opportunities, especially if you see a good wave in a way that you forecast in the future is going to be a good execution, especially the example of Argentina. I was in Argentina last year, and I saw when it was election time, when Macri was speaking to the people, everybody was talking about populism. And in the end, you can see in the first 10 days of his administration, he just started talking with the bondholders, start doing the right thing. We are in election times. Right? Not just because he's here, but in a transition of a new government, you need continuity. That's the most important thing in the future. You can be erased all the transition, all the good things that we are doing and start over again. The first 100 days of Fortunio administration, and he's from my other party, I just want to clarify that. It's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece how you implement that law, how you pass it to the House and the Senate, and then start execution. He got short. Maybe in his mind he said, you know, have to pass more of those laws, or more tools to control the animal of politics. But if we have an opportunity to have a new government that make continuity and reestablish the credibility of the island, those investors, those people who take the risks now, will profit in the future. But it's very important to a good choice in the next couple of months. It's the life of not just the Puerto Ricans, it's the life of all these people who has been investing in the island. And we need good news, we need a good wave in a way that we can reestablish the credibility and the continuity of the rigid, disciplined government. So that's the basic thing that we need in government, rigid and disciplined government.
So we've heard a call for an unpopular, single-term, technocratic Federal Financial Control Board to come in. And let's hear if the audience has a handful of questions that we can get a conversation going with the group in here today. So we'll take first question right here. And wait for the mic, if you will. It's just right on the way.
Hi, John Komorowski. I'm a private citizen. And we're, as CEO Cheney pointed out, we're at the American Security Project, which is kind of the intersection of national security and foreign affairs. And I'm wondering, does this debt crisis have implications for the security, say, of Puerto Rico? You were talking about China wanting to invest in it before. And conversely, the other way around, does the national security of the United States with bases in Puerto Rico have implications that are going to be affected by the policy that you're talking about with regard to the debt crisis?
It's a great question. And in the background of that question, as we speak, Puerto Rico's ground zero for the Zika crisis as well. So as the fate of the island goes, so goes the fate of the country in many respects. But anybody want to answer more specifically on the national security angle?
Well, I must say, I during my tenure as governor, I come up here over and over again, meet with Homeland Security, Coast Guard, FBI, you name it. We establish a very close relationship with the federal agencies in terms of border security because as a direct result of what was happening in the U.S.-Mexican border, a lot of drug trafficking and illegal arms trafficking moved to the Eastern Caribbean. Any kind of that kind of trafficking actually will increase the level of violence anywhere and was increasing it all over the region. And I must say that it was very difficult to get the federal government to understand that, as I called, we were the third border. And all borders had to be protected. And very difficult to get this message across. I wonder if, you know, we were Arizona or any other state, the reaction would have been different. Contrary to what I saw in the heads of the federal agencies at the state level, at the local level, we established a very close relationship with the head of the FBI, the head of the Coast Guard operations in Puerto Rico. There are two bases in Puerto Rico. The U.S. Attorney's Office, and so on and so forth. And actually, to the point where we forge a formal agreement where any individual that was accused of one of the eight most violent crimes in Puerto Rico will be taken by the state police to the federal agencies and will be processed federally. And that, I must say, cleaned up the streets tremendously starting in, you know, from 2011 on, and that has been maintained.
So we have a question right here.
Thank you for your time today. Jamie McInerney, FTI Consulting. Three-part question, but all short. First one is there a sort of upcoming mechanism where PREPA could accept more independent power producers onto the system? And how quickly could that happen, and what would it look like? And then longer term, what would it take for PREPA to sort of really just become an operator of the transmission grid and allow the market to be fully deregulated?
The actual law enacted a couple days ago give you the tools to do that. We can raise new opportunities to generation of energy, not for the distribution. The distribution will still in the hands of PREPA.
Actually, if I may add, there was a piece of legislation that was introduced by the President of the Senate and that was approved in the House and the Senate that actually its goal is to create a truly competitive energy marketplace in terms of power generation. I warn you, however, echoing what Alejandro said earlier, the moment you start, we did a couple of highways, we did the airport, we were doing some public buildings, and the power authority unions immediately said, you know, this guy is crazy, he will privatize power generation, and they were in a strike for the last 3 months of my administration until the day after the election. So I warn everyone here that what it's likely to occur anyway.
But in the end is execution. We have enacted Act 66. We passed the pain of passage in the House and the Senate. I'm the creator of this law. And you don't have the executive to use it in the right way. This is a Republican structure of governance. Legislators, judicial, and the executive. In the end, it's 1% legislation, 90%, 99% execution. So those things can be happened now.
But the problem is that
you need to have the guts and the power to do it.
You can legislate all you want. I mean, it was legislated by this year, 16% of all energy in Puerto Rico was going to be renewable energy. They wiped themselves with that. That went to nothing. So I want to build a project that it's like 50 acres, and I want to be off-grid completely. And for that, I need two General Electric jetpack motors. It's going to cost me $5 million. And the same $5 million, it's what PREPA is blackmailing me that I have to do an improvement to connect to their electricity. Because it's not there. The electricity in Puerto Rico is expensive, but it's also bad and unreliable. Rolling blackouts, sabotage, old lines. It's like, and the president of the Senate, Batia, said, it's like a 1959 Chevy in Cuba. It runs, but the pieces are old. I mean, we're burning Bunker C fuel, which is a lot more expensive, which is part of the paradox of Puerto Rico. EPA makes us burn, you know, low sulfur, basically diesel, even though we have 600,000 septic tanks that contaminate the water. But they are going to torpedo me and make my life impossible to be off-grid, because the moment that I'm off-grid, that's 50 mega less that they have for me to pay the bloody $9 billion debt. So they're going to hold me hostage, make me buy that bad energy, expensive, unreliable, and keep me there, you know? And they have the tools to do it. I mean, PREPA has the keys, the ball, the glove, the keys to the park, everything. If they don't give you the okay, you're not building your project. And that's a danger that we have right now. I wish that all my things were off-grid. They are planning to penalize people who have solar roofs. So the guy who put his stuff on the roof, now they want to pass a law that, you got to pay me a little connecting tax and a surcharge, because when PREPA sells you electricity for 25 cents and it buys it from you at 7, it's not the wheeling, the net metering, you know what I mean? You're minus 3x every time. So it's hard. And somebody has to pay the bondholders their $9 billion. Well, 9 minus the 15% that was the great negotiation that we're paying people to carry for us.
And I guess this underscores that at every turn there's a false choice. For the business community and many manufacturing plants and many pharmaceutical companies are trying to get off grid and stay on the island as investors and operators, but doing so comes with a potential penalty. Paying bondholders over with a shrinking tax base is, of course, incredibly difficult, which is why some advocates of Chapter 9 and some degree of equality for citizenship go a long way. And I think the subtext of this discussion is, of course, the final status of Puerto Rico. It's easy to neglect your territory coming from Washington looking at the island, and it might be a little difficult if Puerto Rico had a vote for the president from the island itself, we'd get a little bit more attention. And so I think the subtext of this discussion is one of status as much as it is a technical conversation about debt restructuring. The question in the back.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Scott Morgan. I want to thank you for this presentation. One thing that has been a leftover from the Spanish-American War is also Lewis talking about how all commerce going into Puerto Rico has to come to the mainland and then get transferred onto U.S. flagged vessels, and then it gets sent to Puerto Rico. If that was amended, how would that help the Puerto Rican business community besides potentially creating new revenue streams?
This is not an issue, just one solution for a complex problem. That's what, as the governor said, we can't support an oversight or control board with a package, including the Jones Act, including reestablish the relation with the manufacturers and the certainty of some kind of structure like 1936 in the past. That doesn't have to be the same, but at least you have the certainty of establishment. Those are things that you can see and opportunities to, inside a package, you can fix the problem of the island. But it's not just one thing. It's like he said, you can fix the problem just raising revenues or just cutting just the budget. It has to be a balanced system. So you attend the debt service, control the expenditure, and balance the revenue system in a way that you can have economic growth.
Well, the Jones Act, I mean, the shipping companies and the petroleum cartel has been trying to break it up for years. It's very powerful. I mean, it's basically the people who control the rail lines want to transport everything, primarily oil, through rail lines. And you have Warren Buffett that is the owner of most of them. So, I mean, good luck with that. But the Virgin Islands, it doesn't apply to them. And they're next to us. So, I mean, they're, you see the Virgin Islands from Puerto Rico on a clear day. Why doesn't it apply to them? And I think it did Marianas or something like that. That I don't.
Well, it's the Jones Act has three elements. It's the shipbuilding requirement, the flagging requirement, and the crew requirement. In the case of Guam, the shipbuilding requirement was waived. In the case of Puerto Rico, only in terms of the building of the cruise ships for tourism purposes. And actually, after that, the cruise ship industry exploded, you know, and multiplied by I don't know how many times after as a result of that. At this moment, there used to be three major shipping companies servicing Puerto Rico, all three indicted for price fixing. There are only two that are left at this moment. So you have a situation where there is competitive forces of the marketplace.
The biggest boat sank.
Exactly. The largest one sank a couple months ago in a storm in the Atlantic. So you have a situation where it's really the competitive forces are not there to bring down the cost. I can tell you that I go grocery shopping in Puerto Rico and here, both places. And it's a lot cheaper in D.C. than in Puerto Rico to buy groceries, believe it or not.
But also that we could buy oil and fuel instead of from Venezuela or sworn enemies or Brazil or Russia, Lukoil. I mean, we could buy it in West Texas, you know, and get the and benefit in the lowering of the prices of gas and the oversupply that is in Cushing, Oklahoma. Instead, we're buying it. I mean, forget about the ship. What is more expensive, the Nike shoes or the shipping and handling? You know, I mean, we're not buying the big items from the States because we have this situation. And it also has to do with security, food security. I mean, there was no fresh fruit for 2 weeks in Puerto Rico, in Costco and Walmart, because this barge that was 800 feet and is the biggest one of them all that we had sank. And that was, you know, when a country gets poorer, they depend a lot more on refrigerated things. That's why people go to Costco and they buy drumsticks of chicken for a year. I mean, the only thing that is going better in Puerto Rico is refrigerated warehouses. Because as a population gets poorer, they buy more refrigerated products, frozen pizza, frozen chicken, things that are not fresh. You know, that's why the French live so long.
Over 80% of what we eat is imported.
Exactly.
Over 80%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we're running just out of time. I'm curious if I could invoke moderator's privilege and try to get any optimistic remarks from these panelists today. Because what I'm hearing is the La Isla del Encanto might be in quite a bit of trouble, but I'm curious if you see any silver lining in the cloud. And Governor, we'll start with you.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I believe this situation is dire. But it presents an opportunity if we get it right. And at this moment, we need assistance, but we have to help ourselves as well. And that's what I have been insisting on doing. And I'm hopeful that if Congress acts, that it will be in a holistic way, and that it will allow for the island to have the tools to move forward. A lot of people I meet, a lot of people when time I spend down there, people want to stay there. I meet people up here that want to go back. So, and especially, you know, after this winter was mild here, but after, you know, more colder winters, a lot of people actually rethink over and over again, what are they doing here? And certainly it's a beautiful island, great people, and excellent weather. The conditions must be there so that people will be able to take risks in terms of their capital, their future, what have you, and see the fruits of their hard work. If those conditions are not there, if that levels of economic freedom are not there, the economy will not be able to grow. So I'm hopeful that indeed economic freedom will grow. And I'm with this, I will end. I was voted out, and the main issue was that I had to lay off thousands of Gorman employees. I'm hearing a lot of people saying, you know, we should have cut more expenses. I understand now why you were doing what you were doing. We should have done even more. A lot of people are starting to understand, and it's not just layoffs. It's many other things, emerging agencies, eliminating Gorman agencies, and trying to make, essentially live within our means. We live within our means, we will be able to actually get our fiscal house in order again.
You got one over here from the other party. Since 2013, I've been a loner, shouting everybody, crisis, crisis, crisis. And, hey, we have to start working on it. But what's institutionalized denial? Established by Fortaleza, by the government, the leaders in my own party. Nobody want to touch the crisis, even with a 20-foot stick. And reality check, at least for me, everybody understand we really are inside a crisis and we have to act. And for that on, that is positive, because that's the only thing, the only way you can fix problems is people recognize it. People in the island and in D.C. and in New York and around the world understand that people, Puerto Rico is in a crisis, we need help, but we need to start help ourselves first. Has to be in the hands of the Puerto Ricans. At least the Puerto Ricans understand we have the crisis, that that is really positive. That is a silver lining. Do you want? That is positive.
Thank you.
I'm a real estate developer, so I guess that I am optimistic by nature. And I am doing ground-up development in Puerto Rico. And Governor Fortuna mentioned the P3s. In 2 months, we're going to open the first non-state government toll road in Puerto Rico. So there's opportunities. The government, I have this piece of land that I owned, and I was at a dead end, and it was zoned commercial. I needed this road to go there, just like the people from National Harbor needed that bridge. And I took this cue, and I'm like, hey, what if I build a toll road? And I'm like, oh, that's impossible. And after 17 years, I was able to hammer it through. But it was when the governor of Puerto Rico had no credit. So the highway authority couldn't build it themselves. They torpedoed it because it looked bad on them. But finally, there was some political will because it was a toll road approved by Governor Fortuño, but the sitting governor continued it. It's like Law 20 and 22 was approved by him. And it goes against the principles of statehood of the IRS. It's about using Puerto Rican powers of taxation to bring investment. So our road that created 300 jobs and is going to pay for itself because it has a 60-cent electronic toll was able to be built because there was continuity and harmony in the position of one administration to another. And as long as we do that and we continue projects that work, like that one and Law 20 and 22, and the privatization of the airport that was done by Fortuño but ratified by the previous governor, I think that we're in good standing. But we definitely need, at this moment, some help from the federal government, not only monetary, but also regulatory, more than anything. But I think that Puerto Rico is going to, I'm buying things in Puerto Rico from the FDIC at 10 cents on $10 a meter, which is incredible. But and I believe that it's going to get better. I have a 1.5-year-old kid, so I want him to grow up in Puerto Rico and not somewhere else.
A positively optimistic final statement. Thank you very much, and thank you to our guests and the American Security Project for hosting this event.